everybody, grab your snacks, grab your drinks. I know I grabbed one, and brother, I think you've got a coffee over there. And we are here for a fun episode of Chop On. If you're joining us for the very first time, thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you enjoy the show. We appear every Wednesday in the U.S. at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursday morning in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Chop On Pod. We have our link tree attached to those pages in our bio so you don't miss one episode of Chop On. Once you find that platform, please like, rate, review. Most importantly, though, please subscribe to your favorite podcast that blends together cricket and wrestling. My name is Rajiv, and I am here with the one, the only ultimate babyface, Bharat Sundaresan. Hello, brother. How are you doing this week?
Well, I'm doing absolutely fine, Rajiv. I hope everyone's fine. I hope everyone's doing well. I wish all the success in the world to everyone. This is just me doing my babyface promo. But you wait.
It sounds like you're about to turn heel on us the way you're doing it.
Yeah. This is just a tease. It's not happening anytime soon, but it's going to happen. I'm not a John Cena. And, well, I there is a reason why I brought up John Cena. But, you know, I have no qualms with turning heel. I've always wanted to be a heel. But, well, for now, I am the ultimate babyface. So you can enjoy it for as long as it lasts. And speaking of ultimate baby faces, you got a little follow from a certain John Cena, Rajiv. Do you want to talk about it?
I have another podcast for those that don't know, Talking Dreams. It comes out on Fridays. And John Cena's personal Twitter account followed Talking Dreams. And then that was followed up by Jeff Jarrett. I don't know. You go from the ultimate baby face to the ultimate fast forward button. So I don't know how to feel about that one. But then we got one Conrad Thompson that decided to join the fray as well. And he followed Talking Dreams, so big things are happening for Talking Dreams, and hopefully Chop On is not too far behind.
I think everybody has dreams, and the three guys you spoke about, Cena, Conrad Thompson, and Jeff Jarrett, wrestling legends of the wrestling world, they don't mind talking about their dreams, and they don't mind talking in general. So I think it's just the start of something special for Talking Dreams. I've had the honor and the pleasure of being on that show twice. So, you've spent enough time with the bottom scratchers. Now it's time for the creme de la creme to come on your show and, make it what it is. It's a wonderful show for everyone listening to this. Go out of your way, as they say. And you don't really have to go out of your way. It's right there, Talking Dreams. We will share the link to that. It's a wonderful podcast. You get to hear a lot about people, their real stories. Eric Bischoff was on it. I found out so much about Eric Bischoff from listening to Talking Dreams, despite having listened to him on 83 Weeks, his podcast for over 3 years and having watched him on TV. So a lot to learn from Talking Dreams and a lot to learn from what we are about to do now. Yes.
Thank you so much for the plug there, brother. It is always good to have some sort of publicity, and I can't thank you enough. And you are not a bottom feeder. You are definitely one of the creme de la creme of Talking Dreams. I told you before, yours is still the highest downloaded episode, so you have that championship around your waist, and we'll see if anybody else wants to take you down. But before that happens, we are going to rotate the strike. What we do here is we take topics related to cricket and wrestling and discuss them for 5 minutes maximum each. If we end the topic before the 5 minute mark, then great. Otherwise, we're going to cut ourselves off at the 5 minute mark. We know we have listeners that love cricket but don't understand wrestling, or love wrestling and maybe don't understand cricket. So towards the end of the show, we are going to enlighten our listeners by having a term or rule of the week. And we also will have a history lesson, which I'm looking forward to you talking about today, brother. So I think it's time for us to walk up to the crease and rotate the strike. What do you think?
I say one.
All right. Let's do it. Our first topic today is that guy, John Cena. Here he is again. He said in an interview on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon that he has not wrestled his last match. He stated that he is not sure when he will be returning to the ring because of the insurance that is put on actors when they are in films, but he did state that he's excited to return to the ring and be in front of fans again. In an interview with the New York Post, Triple H was asked about potential returns of big names such as John Cena and The Rock. And he was quoted as saying, "No matter how busy they are, I know that anytime there's an opportunity where you would say to them, hey, you could enter the ring in WWE and do this, there's a part of them that goes, ooh, that sounds like a lot of fun. Though it's not official, it is heavily rumored that John Cena will challenge Roman Reigns for the WWE Universal Championship at SummerSlam in Las Vegas later this summer. First, brother, what are your thoughts on a John Cena return? And secondly, what do you think about him potentially vying for the championship when he has not been in the company for quite some time?"
Have you heard about this so often, right, Rajiv, about guys who have moved on from wrestling to other careers, especially acting, and become major stars? Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, of course, right on top of that list. We've seen John Cena, Dave Bautista, and so many others, not just acting WWE-sponsored movies, but in real Hollywood, and become stars there. But you always hear other wrestling luminaries talk about how the rush that you get from walking out in front of a wrestling audience cannot be matched. There's something about it. There's something about performing in front of a live crowd that cannot take away, that just, like, you know, cannot match up to anything else. Like, you know, I have very little experience of that when we used to have the heavy metal band. It was just 300 people. But just the, like, you know, just being on top of a stage, at times it was just a wooden board. So you're not really on top of them. But, you know, just to see them, and they're there to see you or listen to you. It's just, I don't think I've ever experienced that kind of rush in my journalistic career. Maybe at times, but never the same. And it's the same for these guys. You know, they're so used to that. That's where they experienced it for the first time as wrestlers, right? Walking out to a big pop. And now that like crowds are going to return to, like, you know, the WWE arenas or arenas around the country for wrestling, and the WWE, like AEW, is going to hit the roads very, very soon. The stage is finally set for not just a John Cena, but even a Rock, because I think Roman Reigns has now become that heel, right? He's become the ultimate heel, which the kind of heel that we haven't seen in wrestling for a long time. I think already, even in this, he's been a heel for a year now, just over a year. I think he's already, in my book, amongst the top three or four heels ever in wrestling. And I'm not even kidding. Just the character he's played and how he's grown within that character is sensational. Maybe he's got some help from the booking team, the writing team. But personally, I think Roman Reigns is right up there. And the stage is set for someone like an ultimate, like, you know, the ultimate babyface we spoke about, a John Cena or a Rock. And with, we've heard about Rock versus Roman Reigns in the past. And, you know, of course, with them, you're talking family lineage, you know, The Rock, and they come from the same family, the same bloodline in many ways. So it has that added intensity. We saw John Cena and Roman Reigns try something similar when in 2017, was it? When I thought John Cena cut that incredible shoot promo against Roman Reigns, you know, where Roman Reigns stuttered and, like, you know, couldn't find his promo. I think it's one of my favorite clips to watch. I always recommend that to people who have a slight interest in wrestling. Even now, if you want to go and look it up, John Cena when he buried Roman Reigns. I thought that feud was built up really strongly, but this was also at a time when WWE were force feeding Roman Reigns to their fans. But now Roman Reigns has reached the pinnacle in my opinion as a heel. The stage could be set for a John Cena return for SummerSlam, and maybe the big WrestleMania main event next year, Rock versus Roman Reigns. That wouldn't surprise me. And about, like, should he vie for the title? You know, he's not going to win it. I would be shocked, but I think he should vie for the title. I mean, you have to vie for the top dog. You can't. We've seen guys like them come in and have, like, an exhibition match of sorts, right? Like, you know, Rock and someone versus Triple H, and or Undertaker versus John Cena. It just doesn't cut it for me. And imagine already Roman Reigns, like I said, is close to the top of the tree. Getting a win or getting into a feud with John Cena at this stage of his career would just like, yeah, take him, I think tip him over the line. He might become the greatest ever. So I'm very excited about the prospect and I do see it happening. But just one interesting thing about that was it's something that professional sportsmen who are sports people who sign contracts also have it in their contract that they, like the Indian cricketers, for example, can't go bungee jumping or can't indulge in adventure activities because you're insured, right? I mean, but you're insured for injuries that you might get while playing the sport or while training for the sport. I mean, you can't go on a jet ski and like, you know, blow your knee out. And I don't think the contract covers that. So I'm quite fascinated by the fact that that those kind of clauses exist even in Hollywood.
Yeah, they definitely do exist. I remember when The Rock had come back to fight John Cena and he got injured in their match, he had to push the shooting of, I think it was the Hercules movie, and the producers were not happy because they had all this money invested and he went and got hurt doing something else. So that's why he's a lot more cautious about when he can come back himself. But brother, I've told you before off air that I was one of the ones that was always chanting Cena sucks. But, you know, at the end of the day, he is a great performer who drew a lot of money for WWE. And I would like to note that I said performer. I think for wrestling, he is good, but not great. He does step it up when he needs to, but he was never going to be a high flyer doing crazy moves. We all knew that very early on into his career. Now, as far as going for the title, I think this will definitely bring some attention to SummerSlam if he's actually going to be there for it. But I think this is for that match I was talking about with him and The Rock. This is the same issue that John Cena claimed to have with The Rock. The Rock disappeared for a while and then he's going for the title all of a sudden out of nowhere. I see why WWE wants to do this sort of thing. And I would definitely be looking forward to a Roman Reigns, John Cena match, if only for those promos, because you know, now that Roman Reigns is a heel, he's going to bring up that time that John Cena called him out and he's going to try to make John Cena look silly. And I don't know if I would agree with you that Roman Reigns is in the top three or four heels of all time. He's definitely the top one today. His character work has done really well. He's been doing well with the promos. I love everything that he's doing. But, you know, to me, this makes John Cena look a bit like a hypocrite because of his past comments for The Rock.
It does. And it can all be weaved beautifully into a storyline, which is what wrestling is. You know, I mean, it's the most hypocritical industry in that sense. If you take kayfabe seriously, I mean, if you start taking the storyline seriously, if not, like there would be no heel turn, there would be no face turn. Right? Like it's built around hypocrisy, the whole industry in many ways.
Speaking of going for a face turn, USA and Pakistan are among 17 member nations that have expressed interest to host ICC tournaments in the 2024 through 2031 FTP cycle. The other countries that submitted a preliminary technical proposal to the ICC for the same are Australia, Bangladesh, England, India, Ireland, Malaysia, Namibia, New Zealand, Oman, Scotland, South Africa, Sri Lanka, West Indies, UAE, and Zimbabwe. Post the 2023 World Cup, which is slated to be held in India, there will be 8 global tournaments in the 8-year cycle. The events include 2 men's World Cups, 4 men's T20 World Cups, and 2 Champions Trophies. The ICC said that the host for the World Test Championship Final, the women's and under-19 events in the new cycle, will be determined in a separate process and will be done later in the year. So do you think the U.S. has a chance at holding any of these events in the next cycle, or do you think they should take time to build up cricket in the country before taking that on? And my gut tells me that USA Cricket should just focus on building cricket here in the U.S. to make themselves somewhat of a powerhouse. Maybe not in the top three. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But definitely build your name up, make yourself reputable. Then you can go do things and vie for attention to host ICC tournaments. I mean, perhaps the thinking here is that if the ICC lets them host a tournament or two here, then maybe that's going to help them grow in the long run. But I really think they need to focus on themselves internally to build themselves externally before focusing on things outside like hosting. But like we've said many times on this show, I've only been watching and reading about cricket since 2015. So perhaps, brother, this is a smart thing to do to build your board up. I don't know. What say you?
Well, the ICC, Rajiv, have been very interested in somehow taking cricket to the US. We've seen it with Masters tournaments, like when Shane Warne and Sachin Tendulkar came up with a Masters tournament back in 2016 or 17. It's been a while. And then, like, you know, the West Indies have played a few international matches of their own in the US. You know, they've hosted India and T20Is in Lauderdale, Fort Lauderdale. You have to help me with, it's in Florida, right?
Yes, it's in Florida. I went once for the CPL, actually. They had they had four matches there a few years ago.
Ah, there you go. So yeah, they've had like hosted CPL matches there. So I don't see a major, like a senior men's event or even a women's event coming to the US anytime soon. But an under 19 World Cup, again, maybe not in within the first 4 years of that cycle, but the latter half of that 8 year cycle might not be a bad idea. You know, like we've spoken about in the past, the grassroots system seems to be strengthening with every passing week. They seem to be investing not just money, but energy in, you know, cultivating that kind of a culture, not just for boys and men, but for girls and women as well. So those are all good signs for US cricket. And we've spoken about this also in the past about how there's been a lot of investment coming in from some pretty big names in, you know, Indian society, Bollywood actors, and other big industrialists and businessmen as well, business people as well. So it all augurs well for US cricket, and I actually believe that all they have to do is even give an orange signal to the ICC, as I am sure the ICC will be very keen on taking, like I said, an under 19 World Cup for sure. And these days, the under 19 World Cup is broadcast around the world. I mean, it has been for the last 10 years. So it gets a lot of eyeballs. You have all high-profile commentators. Like Suvian Bishop loves the Under-19 World Cup. Nasser Hussain and those guys, Simon Dool, are always around for these events. So it does get a lot of coverage and a lot of traction. So in my book, I think a Junior World Cup or something like that will not be a bad idea. Will also be interesting to see who gets a lot of these major events, because there is this talk from countries like South Africa and New Zealand and the rest about how it's generally shared around by the big three, India, Australia and England. Like the last 350 over World Cups, 2015 was Australia and New Zealand, 2019 England, and now 2023 in India. India have had the last two World T20s because Australia's one last year has been postponed to next year. So generally, they seem to have like really monopolized. I remember growing up, it used to be, I used to get like, you know, very excited whenever they would announce the cycle, because you knew eight years in advance where the next World Cup would be. And it was shared pretty fairly. Like, you know, after England dominated the first three World Cups in terms of hosting it, 87, it came to the subcontinent. 92 was Australia. 96, it came back to the subcontinent, India, Sri Lanka and Pakistan, where cricket really blew up in terms of money. Then they went back to England, then South Africa, then the West Indies and back to India. So, we haven't seen a major men's event in either a South Africa or a West Indies in a long time. So, you know, especially South Africa, I don't remember them hosting anything since the 2009 Champions Trophy. So, it'll be good if cricket can go back there. Look, we also have to keep in mind that, you know, the world is always still dealing with the pandemic. You know, we don't need to go into great detail, but yes, just yesterday, England have been rocked by the virus. As we know, three players have tested positive and four support staff as well. So they've just brought in 9 uncapped players into their squad for a series against Pakistan. So that needs to be kept in mind as well. But in that sense, the US have left a lot of the world behind. Things are opening up just much like the UK. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we'll get a men's World Cup in the US in 5 years' time.
What a huge baby face turn that would be for them after all of their controversies and downfalls. Exactly. That would be That would be interesting. Speaking of interesting, in order to be fully fit for the Ashes later this year, Steve Smith has said that he could rule himself out for the T20 World Cup if the need arises. While he remains hopeful of participating in both the World Cup and the Ashes, he is not against giving up the former for the latter. Smith would say to cricket.com.au, and I quote, "There is still a bit of time between now and the T20 World Cup, and I am tracking okay at the moment. It's slow, but I'm going okay. I'd love to be a part of the World Cup for sure, but from my point of view, test cricket, that's my main goal. To be right for the Ashes and try to emulate what I've done in the last few Ashes series I've been involved in." First of all, what does this say about how much of a purist Steve Smith is, and is this a big blow to not just the T20 World Cup, but to T20 as a format?
I wouldn't think it's a big blow to T20 as a format or even Australia's chances at the World Cup. I mean, as great a batsman as Steve Smith is, his T20 game, that's not his strongest format. Like, he's scored some great centuries, played some great knocks, of course, not just for Australia, but occasionally in the IPL. But we've seen in the last 2 years, especially, he's not really... there was a one series against Sri Lanka or Pakistan in Australia, I think 2 summers ago, where he was scoring runs for fun. But it's a format you look at Steve Smith in and you think you can do without it, do away with it, to start with. And with the Ashes, one thing, I keep harping on this all the time, the Ashes is the WrestleMania of cricket. They, in Australia and in England, they talk about it 18 months in advance. Like, once one Ashes series finishes, it's always the next one that they talk about. So, and look at his record against England in Ashes series. He's can't stop scoring runs. Last 2 years ago when I covered my first Ashes, goes to England after a 1 year, suspension for Cape Town, and goes on and makes all those runs. He is a purist for sure, I think, but so are all the heavyweights of the cricket game. You hear Virat Kohli, Kane Williamson, and Joe Root, all of them talk about Test cricket as being the pinnacle, and it is. It indeed is. I think I'm not surprised by that move. And also, there's so much happening with that Australian team. A lot of them are in the West Indies. A lot of them have backed out the guys who are in the IPL, especially those, most of them, which has meant that, already the T20 team is divided in terms of who does Australia pick for that T20 World Cup, which is in the UAE now, as we know. Do they go for the guys who perform in West Indies, or do they go for the big names, some of whom have missed out, the Warners and the Cummins and the Maxwells of the world? So, and you throw Steve Smith into that mix. He was let go by Rajasthan Royals in the IPL after having been their captain for a long time. He was bought by Delhi, but he didn't perform any miracle for them. Like, he wasn't really at the top of his game in that format for them. So I don't think it's a big loss for Australia. And again, when you think of Steve Smith, as big a player as he is, you don't think of him as a T20 star. So I don't think it takes away from the tournament, really.
Well, brother, here we go with a little bit of a disagreement here. The Test cricket fan in me absolutely loves this. Test cricket is the purest form of the game, and a healthy Steve Smith is always a treat to watch, especially in the Test format. But this, to me, does give a big hit to T20 as a format because, I mean, this is obviously being viewed by one of the top cricketers in the world today of any format, really. I mean, yes, you made good points that he has not been in 100% form in T20, but he's still viewed as a top cricketer in the world no matter what. And the way he's kind of talking about this T20 World Cup is almost like it's a throwaway. Yeah, he states he'd love to be a part of it, but by saying he's thinking of not participating in it at all, it's just acknowledging that Test cricket and the Ashes as a whole are a much bigger deal than this T20 World Cup. So, some view being on an international side of any format as a great way to represent your country, no matter what. But this is telling me that, and you're going to love this metaphor here, this is telling me that the traditional Saudi is going to outweigh the new sexy model in skimpy clothes.
Oh, wow. I don't think I can beat that metaphor. But that brings me back to the one of my favorite stories I wrote in 2016. It was about the attire for the Indian female athletes at the Olympic opening ceremony. You know, they were asked to wear a blazer over their sari. And it was an awkward story to write. I had to speak to like some big names in Indian sport about like, you know, what they thought about wearing a blazer over a sari. Not of them, most of them weren't very happy about it. So yeah, that's the best I can do to match that metaphor of yours. But just a final thought on that. It also, I think, has a lot to do with they're still waiting on the government to give them that clearance, because by the time they come back from the T20 World Cup, there'll be only 2 weeks left for that. They are playing a test against Afghanistan, which is the only warm-up they'll have apart from, especially those the guys who will be in the T20 World Cup. Others will get to play in the Sheffield Shield season, the domestic cricket season. So Mitchell Stark spoke 2 days back, I think, to the media about how he's hopeful that the government will let them, like, you know, get away with not much of a quarantine period because they're all vaccinated also. So, and they can prepare in time for the Ashes. So that's another thing maybe that is bothering Steve Smith.
Perhaps. And speaking of something bothering somebody, beginning tonight as you're listening to this, AEW is hitting the road after working out of Daly's Place in Jacksonville, Florida for the last 60 weeks. Fyter Fest Night 1 will take place on July 14th in Austin, Texas. And so far, the only official match is Brian Cage defending the FTW Championship against Ricky Starks. This will be Starks' return match after being out since April with a fractured neck. Brian Cage took exception to the poster of Fyter Fest that was created for the show, and this is his quote from Twitter, at Starkman Jones versus Cage, only match announced and can't get on the poster after selling out. Ricky's hometown and Austin is the wrestling tent that I built, hashtag Wrestle Circus. For those that don't know, Wrestle Circus was a popular yet short-lived indie promotion based out of Austin, Texas, where Brian Cage was a two-time Ringmaster champion and a one-time sideshow champion for the company. So does Brian Cage have a legitimate gripe here, or is he making a big deal out of nothing? And I think he's making a big deal out of nothing. Posters are generally made early when nothing is set in stone or even announced, so that arenas, television networks, and cable outlets can advertise that the show is happening. This poster was likely made when AEW announced they were hitting the road and they didn't know exactly what they were going to have, but you throw your biggest stars on the poster because you believe that they're going to be there and you want to advertise that a big show is coming to a particular market. So let's be honest, while I do love Ricky Starks and I do like Brian Cage a lot, they are not the biggest stars in the company. AEW can always make alterations to marketing posters down the road, and usually wrestling companies do. So they're likely to feature on a poster eventually. I'm sure they'll even get a nice one made for just their match, as most matches do on big shows for AEW. So to me, this is a big deal over nothing.
I disagree with you. I mean, if I put myself in Brian Cage's position, I kind of understand. Because you look at that poster and you mention Big Show a lot. And the Big Show, Paul White, is in one corner right on top. And the other corner, you see the big frame of Mark Henry. And I know, I mean, they are Hall of Famers. They are legends in their own right. And there's a reason why AEW have brought both of them. And yeah, right next to Big Show is Christian Cage. And you know why they bought these guys in, not just as talents, but also to, you know, act as, you know, inspirations, influences in the back, like, you know, as with all their experience and their knowledge put together. But if I'm a Brian Cage, well, a year ago, I was fighting John Moxley for the AEW world title in, you know, in Fyter Fest. A year on, I still have a title match, right? Like, you know, it is still one of the title belts we've spoken about in the past. You know, it's a Taz title, but FEW title, but, you know, it's still recognized in some form on AEW television. And there are a lot of guys on that poster. I would understand if he was upset with a poster which had, like, just two wrestlers or just a John Moxley and someone. And then he questioned about, like, you know, why it wasn't him and Ricky Starks. But when you have the space to put some 20 faces up there, including the likes of, you know, Big Show and Paul White and Mark Henry and Christian Cage, and the only authorized official match that has been signed involves Brian Cage and Ricky Starks, and they're not there, I think he has every right to be upset about it. Even though the poster might have been printed, like you said, it rightly said, like a few months ago. That's how you promote events in wrestling. You put the big names there. But when you can put 20 names, 20 faces there, I'm sure you could have accommodated a Brian Cage, who is holding a title, as we spoke about, and a Ricky Starks, who's been one of the runaway stars in the last 2 years, ever since AEW really came. And also AEW has positioned themselves as the you know, the darling of the indie world. Like, you know, they've given a lot of independent wrestlers a big go. You know, and they've looked down upon WWE for many reasons, like, you know, at least the AEW fans for just promoting the big names. But, you know, here you have some borrowed big names from the WWE, Mark Henry and Big Show and those guys, and they're on the poster and Brian Cage is not on it. Like, I am with you. I am with Mr. Cage. But the only thing I would say that it got me reading about Wrestle Circus, and I want to go and watch some of those shows. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple matches out there that you can find, and it is definitely a trip. I think that's the best way to describe it. But you, brother, you make some very fair points there. So we'll let the audience decide which side are you on. Are you on the Buddit Sundarisan side, or are you on the Rajiv side? And then we'll decide who is the babyface and who's the heel. So we'll figure it out, though. Moving on to our next segment, Fact or Fiction. I will present a topic, and we will say whether we think it is fact or fiction, and then make arguments as to why that is. Our first statement here is, Eric Bischoff is correct in thinking that today's wrestling commentators are overproduced. Brother, is that fact or fiction?
It's a huge fact. I mean, you can see, we were chatting about this, yesterday on SMS about Jinder Mahal, and, you know, when he walked out with Veer and Shanky. I don't know, we've become these big Veer and Shanky fans, despite I've never seen them wrestle. And I saw them put the beat down on Drew McIntyre yesterday, and honestly, I wasn't very impressed. I was like, yeah, I mean, especially the kicks from Veer, Rinku Singh in real life.
It wasn't great.
Yeah, but a little soft. Like, yeah, they just... And I think, I don't know how comfortable it is wrestling in a dhoti. I have to say that. Dhoti is the big long loincloth that he wears. I mean, I'm sure it's restricting, especially when you're using your legs. But anyway, I'm sure he'll figure a way out. Maybe in the future, he'll walk out and, like, you know, like Riddle, he'll blow the dhoti away and he'll wrestle in tights. Hopefully that doesn't happen. I was lamenting to you about how the commentators are not mentioning them at all. Like, only in passing they would mention Veer or Shanky. And it's not that fluid. You listen to commentary from the 90s, whether it was a Tony Schiavone with Bobby the Brain Heenan especially, but even with the living legend Larry Zbyszko, there used to be some, it used to feel like a conversation. These days, it really does sound, I don't mind promos being produced, but commentators being overproduced or produced just takes away from the match. Like, when you hear, that has to be the most organic aspect of the show, right? Where, like, you know, in commentary in any sport for that matter, we always talk about it, like, you know, when we do commentaries, about it should feel like the two people sitting on the couch watching us on TV feel like they can engage with us, even though technically they can't. Like, it's just two people having a conversation. There is a caller, there is a color commentator. Now, with three of them, there's, like, you know, there's the expert analyst as well. But it should still feel like a conversation where, like, you know, which we would be having on the couch, which doesn't happen at all with WWE. To an extent, even AEW might have Tony Schiavone and Jim Ross, but even there, you can see that they are being produced to an extent. Just the way, just through the flow, and compare that to the wild 90s where on both shows, like, you could hear some pretty interesting things. Like, we spoke about before you pressed record about Hulk Hogan's big turn. I mean, Bobby the Brain Heenan just saying, you know, whose side is he on? Which, you know, like we discussed, I'm sure while watching it, we were thinking about along the same lines about, like, whose side is he on? Like, you know, it wasn't that obvious. And especially with Dusty Rhodes, just to use that comparison, Dusty Rhodes and Tony Schiavone going gaga over Hulk Hogan and, like, you know, who's playing now, boys, or whatever. It it was like, you know, obviously there was someone sitting out there watching it on TV or even in the crowd with the contrarian view saying whose side was he on. And that's what Bobby Heenan said. That can only happen if you're not overproduced. And I think Eric Bischoff is very, very right about it. It's that aspect, I have to stick with anyone who says, oh, the good old days were much better.
Yeah, it's definitely 100% fact. I don't think in 20 years we'll be talking about the amazing announcers that we currently have here in 2021. I mean, a case probably could be made for Corey Graves, but I think he's the only exception out of any of the WWE team. But announcers today are not being given the freedom to be themselves. They have to do or say whatever Vince and or Bruce or even Tony Khan are telling them. And it's making the announcers all sound the same. JR and the King were great at just being who they were. They weren't being overproduced. Yeah, they were being produced some, but you could tell they were not being produced as much as they are today. And I mean, if any leeway, I mean, they were given a lot of leeway from Vince of, oh, you guys can do this and do this. Here is the general thing I want you to bring to the table. And I feel like that's what Tony Khan brings for the most part. Of course, you have to produce them when they're saying, by the way, next week on TNT, because they need to know when to say that. But I feel like other than those promotional things, I don't think Tony Khan's saying much. And you can feel the flow is different between the AEW announcers and the WWE announcers. It feels more to me like the WWE announcers are almost following a script, whereas in AEW, they have bullet points. Here's the promotional things we're talking about during these matches. Hit them at these points and then go ahead and say what you need to say to get these guys over. So in that aspect, I think AEW is doing a better job of producing than WWE is, but both sides are definitely getting overproduced for different reasons. WWE, because Vince wants these things said. AEW, because the network needs you to promote these things. WrestleMania should stay a two-night event even when things are back to some sort of normalcy. Is that fact or fiction? And I say it's fiction. For one, I think the paying crowd may not be able to afford both nights. I know you're going to want fans to be there both nights. Some fans are going to want to come to both nights, but it's hard for people, especially right now after the whole COVID-19 pandemic, to be able to afford things like this. It might be great for the WWE network, but as a fan who's not living and dying by WWE today as I am, it's exhausting trying to get through back-to-back nights. I think you should take your best matches, throw them on one night. Do not go over 4 hours, because when the show is so long, there is fatigue from fans not just watching at home, but definitely for those in attendance. Now, it's probably great for people that eat, drink, breathe, and die for professional wrestling. Sports entertainment. But for the fan that watches, like, I just watch because I like wrestling. And to me, this isn't the greatest idea to keep it as a two-night event.
Well, I disagree with you. I think it's a fact. I mean, what we've seen in the last couple of years, at least, with you know, WrestleMania being stretched over to 2 days, is there are just more WrestleMania moments for a lot more people on that roster, a lot more performers on that roster. And that roster is, yes, they are reducing it all the time, but with the Raw and the SmackDown brand and just so many titles now, and you know, so many more stars, you know, regardless of whether they're men or women, I like the concept of a two-day WrestleMania, but I do believe that, and I agree with you, that a four-hour show is just too long when you count, you know, add all the pre-show shenanigans and, you know, all the chatter and the dark matches and all that. It just becomes a really long show. So maybe if they can keep it snappy, even a 2.5 hour or 3 hour program for both days, I think it can still work. And I'm talking about this purely from it being a network product. For the fans, I'm not sure how that works out for them. You're right. It's not, I'm sure a WrestleMania ticket is not cheap. You are someone who's been to WrestleMania like me. So you're the expert there. So, and I'm sure it's not just the ticket. Everything you get there wouldn't be cheap either, like the beer or even some fries, whatever you get to eat. So But considering wrestling itself is such a TV or a network product, it's a broadcasting product these days, I still think they can pull it off. And I want them to stick to the two-day format. It makes for easier viewing, especially when you're so far away in Australia.
Well, I guess we're going to have to disagree on that one.
We do, Rafi.
South Africa winning the T20 series against the West Indies shows that the Windies have more to fix than just their test side. Brother, is that fact or fiction?
No, I think it's fiction, and I'm not just coming to that point as a West Indian fan, but just seeing these players, I mean, the band is back together. I mean, Chris Gayle and Fidel Edwards opened the bowling together in a T20 match. It's incredible when you think about it. I was passing high school the last time those two opened the bowling together, the first time they played together back in 2003. So it's crazy now. Edwards is back, Gayle's back, you have Drain Bravo's back, you have Pollard and Russell, and then a couple of these big hitting later stars in Puran and Hetmyer, and it's Lendl Simmons is back, another old school name. So I think they're not a team you really can judge in a bilateral series. When you get them to play five matches against the same team over in a week's time, they can be found out like they have were by a very, very impressive South African unit. South Africa have not really been at the top of the game in T20 cricket for a long time. They've never really... South Africa and Australia are two strong cricketing nations who's never really made a big fist of it in the T20 World Cups, over the years. I was pleasantly surprised that South Africa pulled that series off. But this West Indies team is dangerous in a tournament format. That's why they won it twice. They can hit you if they have to play. You get to play them only once. On their day, they can just completely bury you. And even if it's not their day, they'll just find, like, that's what they did in 2016. In the semi-final, the top order, India bowled really well, got Gayle out and some of the top order out, and then Andre Russell came and turned the game. In the final, it came down to my dear friend Marlon Samuels and Carlos Brathwaite, remember the name. So that's the kind of team they are. So it makes them very dangerous in a tournament format. In a bilateral format, they'll have days, but then they'll have days where they can be found out. And that's what happened. And full credit to South Africa for the way they played. But I don't think there's anything to be overly concerned about. They would love to have Sunil Narayan back in the mix as well. He's the only big name missing out from that group. But knowing West Indies, he might be back as well.
Yeah, just hearing you say that they don't do very well in a bilateral series makes me miss the tri-series so much. But I agree with you. It is 100% fiction. I could see why some people might say it's a fact, but I just don't see it being anything long-term, like you're saying. They have so many big hitters, big bowlers on their side. There are many careless mistakes that could have prevented a couple of those South Africa wins. Bowling wasn't consistent throughout the series. The batting relied too heavily on one or two batsmen per match. It was always a different batsman per match that they were relying on, so there wasn't any consistency there. It was just a lot of inconsistencies that need to be worked on and fixed. We have to remember that this Windy squad has not had much T20 action over the last year, so maybe they just need to find their feet again. The CPL's coming up. That's going to be good for them for sure, and they're going to get their head on right and tweak their game to improve themselves and then come back as a team and show everybody why they won that T20 World Cup back in 2016.
Yeah, I have full confidence in that they'll do that.
India participating in a warm-up game with Select County 11 will help them prepare for the test versus England. Is that fact or fiction? And I say it's a fact. They needed this even before the World Test Championship final. As you know, brother, I was on here talking about that adamantly, that New Zealand get two warm-up matches and they're just doing intra-squad matches. This is not done, but this will be good because they'll be playing against players that are in England, not just the intra-squad matches against themselves. It's always good to see opponents that you don't see often or even at all, as that keeps you sharp. It keeps you on your toes. So hopefully this will keep the Indian team up and running. Yes, these are warm-up matches that don't go on fully like a test match would, but it's a good practice to assess the pitches, find holes in your own batting as well as your bowling as a team, adjust, and get ready for the England side for 5 test matches.
Well, you know, this is why it's not just cricket and wrestling which act as milk and cookies. It's you and me as well. I don't know which one's what, but, you know, I might be this, whatever, the cricketing voice. I might get paid to write on cricket, but more often than not, you get it right. Like, you know, you get it right more than I do when it comes to cricket. And I have to agree, you were right. I mean, I based my argument, like, you know, when we spoke about this before the World Test Championship final, about India not playing against an opposition and just, you know, deciding to play intra-squad matches. I mean, their hands were tied at that point. They were in a bubble, so they couldn't play against anyone else. But still, I'd spoken about how India preferred that, because there have been times when they've gone overseas and, you know, and it's not just for India. Most teams, even when they come to India these days, they get a substandard team or a substandard pitch. They, like, for good reason, the host country doesn't want them to be acclimatized as well as they want to be once the real series starts. So teams have preferred center wicket practice or just playing amongst themselves. But having said that, India did benefit a lot from playing one very good opposition against Australia in Australia at the Drummond Oval. So they played one day-night warm-up game at the SCG, which was good. But I thought the bowling attack, Michael Neeser, there was Mark Stecchetti. They bowled really well and tested the Indians. Tim Payne played that game as well at the Drummond Oval. And I thought that prepared them wonderfully well for that Australia series. So, yeah, I mean, they'll benefit greatly from playing anyone who's not Indian or who's not from that mix, because they played enough with each other for now. And there was reports overnight that R. Ashwin is trying to get one county game for Surrey. Like, he's played county cricket in the past, but he's trying to get like one county game for Surrey, which will, you know, help him prepare, get used to the conditions there. So, yeah, I mean, India do have a lot of time to kill. But now it'll also be interesting to see what they are allowed to do after the outbreak in the England team yesterday, which we spoke about earlier. Will there be restrictions placed on them? I mean, the UK seems to have moved on. All restrictions are off as of Monday. Their Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has said. So it'll be interesting to see what they want to do and what they're allowed to do. And we'll find out in the next few days.
And now it is time for my favorite part of the show, terms and conditions with our resident expert, Bharat Sundaresan. Brother, we have a segment that is titled Rotate the Strike. And just to keep in the theme of last week, we talked about the title of our show, Chop On. So I thought it would be nice to talk about what exactly is rotating the strike in cricket.
Well, rotating the strike really gets the cricket world the turning, really. I mean, that's really the most important thing in cricket, because that's how you score runs, unless you hit boundaries. And because we have a lot of listeners in America who are wrestling fans, who hopefully follow baseball, I will use, baseball as a comparative, or as a comparison to explain what rotating the strike is. So in baseball, when you're the batter, you go from one base to another, right? You go from the first base to second base, and then that person goes from the second base to the third base. Unlike that, in cricket, as we've discussed in the past, the pitch is 22 yards. You have a striker, the batter facing the bowler, and the non-striker. And to complete one run, they need to swap ends. So they have to run across from one end to the other. That's what constitutes one run. Like in baseball, you have a home run. So, you hit the ball, like, you know what a home run is. So you kind of score one run. Similarly, a boundary in cricket is if the ball goes along the ground or even bounces once and goes past the boundary rope, that's 4 runs. If you hit it over the boundary rope on the full, that's 6 runs. So you can score your runs through boundaries, or you can rotate the strike by just, unlike in baseball, though, it's not tip and run. So even you decide whether you want to run or not. Even if the ball strikes your bat, you don't necessarily have to run from one base to another and hope to not get run out. So you decide when you want to run or not. That's why cricket is, I mean, you think baseball is slow. Cricket is even more relaxed than baseball is. You can take your time. You take more decisions in life. That's why nobody talks about baseball being a metaphor for life. You know, imagine if baseball was a metaphor for life where, you know, every time you touch something, you had to run. Like, you know, tip and run would not work in real life for sure. Thankfully, that doesn't happen in cricket. That's why it is considered a metaphor for life. You take choices. But then it's on you. If you get run out, you can blame yourself. You don't have to blame the game. But rotate the strike is basically just going from the non-striker's end to the striker's end and completing a run.
I hope baseball is never the metaphor for life, even though I love it. I just, man, no thank you. And brother, our term for professional wrestling this week, easy for me to say, this week is pre-tape. What is a pre-tape in professional wrestling?
Well, pre-tape in just a broader understanding of that term is pretty much what wrestling was for years. Everything was pre-taped. I mean, wrestling wasn't always live. And initially, it was more an arena sport or an arena performance. So even though the TV was used to kind of build up to that big arena perform, whether it was, there were no pay-per-views back in the 70s and the 80s. So TV was always pre-taped. TV shows that you would see, they would record 2-3 shows in a week, in a day at times. And like, you know, and then you would get to see it on TV over the next 2-3 weeks. And that continued, you know, till the 90s, still Eric Bischoff decided to go live. I mean, there were live shows. There were some live shows, but most of wrestling on TV was pre-taped. Unlike now, where they use TV to build up to a pay-per-view or live shows to build up to a TV, back then it was all about building up, using TV. That's why you rarely saw the big names wrestle on TV. It would generally be in a big arena, you know, whether if it was the NWA or WCW at the Omni, or, you know, if it was WWE, or WWE, it would be at Madison Square Garden. Those were their big events, like with Andre the Giant and those guys, even before WrestleMania became a thing. So it was all pre-taped, and we've gone back to the era of pre-taped in the last couple of years, thanks to the pandemic, where both WWE and AEW, because they've stuck to either Orlando for WWE, the Performance Center, or Daly's Place for AEW. So they've pre-taped a lot of their shows, just so that, like, you know, they can save up on travel, and you don't want people traveling around too much during this pandemic. So we've gone back to the pre-taped era. And I think both promotions have still had pre-taped shows alongside their live shows. I mean, back in the day, you could there were events like Sunday Night, what is it called? The WWE one, Sunday Night Heat. Or, you know, WCW had Saturday Night Live or Saturday Night shows, like, you know, which at times said live, but they weren't always live. So I think pre-tape matches or pre-tape shows have always been a part of wrestling, and they'll continue to be so. I mean, you want a couple of live shows, but you still want to get a few shows in your bank, so that you, especially in today's day and age, when you never know when there'll be restrictions and when there'll be border shutdowns. I hope I got that right.
Oh, yes, you did. 100%. Well done, brother. And now it is time to go over the ropes. This is where we go over the ropes of the present back into the past. Brother, there is one name in India that is synonymous with cricket, and his name is Sachin Tendulkar. What can you tell us about this man that is viewed as a god to many Indians around the world?
Well, Sachin Tendulkar's career lasted for 24 years, and so will this monologue, because so if you're listening to this, you'll be really, really old by the time I finish, because it'll take me that long to really explain what Sachin Tendulkar is. You know, we spoke about, you had Don Bradman on, and that I took a long time to explain to especially our American viewers what Don Bradman is. Like, if there's anyone listening to this who knows cricket and wants to know about Sachin Tendulkar, I'm sure they'll be switching it off right now. There's nothing new I can tell you about Sachin Tendulkar that you don't know already, especially if you're Indian. But he really defined India as a country. You know, well, everybody knows about his cricketing achievements. He's a world record holder in so many runs, most number of hundreds, most runs in test cricket, most runs in one day cricket. There are some records that nobody will touch. He was, you know, he was a child prodigy. By the time he was 14, he was looked at as a potential India player. He made his first class domestic debut for Mumbai when he was just 14. Before he turned 16, or just around the time he turned 16, he was picked for India for a tour of Pakistan in 1989. And that pretty much started the Tendulkar era, not just for world cricket, not just for Indian cricket, but for India as a country, because, you know, it coincided with India opening up, you know, the globalization, as it's called, with the whole Narasimha Rao government in the early 90s, started, you know, just around the time that Sachin Tendulkar became a big deal in world cricket. And he was always, I mean, people had heard about him even before he, you know, started playing for India around the world. You know, there are interview clips, if you can find it. The great late Tom Walter, I think, was one of the first people to interview him. And that's a wonderful clip of him talking about what it feels like for him to go on a tour of the West Indies to face all those big guys when you're just 16, 17. And yeah, I mean, he just defined India as an era, or India as a country during the 90s. There's so much more money came into India. India opened up, like I said. Well, I mean, that's when we discovered wrestling. And, you know, Sachin Tendulkar and wrestling in many ways go hand in hand for my generation, like, you know, people who were in school during the 90s. Because, yeah, I mean, he really meant, you know, he was our trump card. Like, you know, he was our trump, and by our, I mean India's trump card to the world. I remember when my brother moved to the US in 2002, when he bought his first car, he you know, it was the first time he was in a country where you could get customized nameplates. So the nameplate he went for was Stenlia, which was like one of the many nicknames that Sachin Tendulkar had. And he drove that car around for a while. And then someone, this is when he was still a student, some other Indian expat in the US paid him a lot of money to buy that name, get that nameplate off him. My brother was very happy. He made a fortune. And that's seriously just one little tidbit of why, how big that Tendulkar name is. I mean, he's Sachin Tendulkar, how old is he? He's turned 48 now, but you know, he played, started at 16, retired famously in 2013. Like a whole country, whole nation, billions of people just wept with Sachin Tendulkar when, you know, it was over, because he was so synonymous with cricket, with our way of life for, you know, 2.5 decades. You suddenly felt this big vacuum. I was never an Indian cricket fan, but I was there at the Wankhede covering that match. And, you know, just especially when he gives his famous speech at the end, I was downstairs. My boss had the who's who of Indian cricket journalism, the who's who of the world, like, you know, had assembled to say goodbye to Sachin Tendulkar. And I remember my boss said, like, just go down and figure out what's happening, you know, get a gauge of the mood of the crowd. Like, you know, there were people, grown men and grown women, shedding tears in the press box as well. I was a little about it. So I just went down. And I remember three other legends of the Indian game, Ganguly, Dravid and Lakshman, you know, played a lot of cricket with Sachin Tendulkar, who were doing commentary on that game. They were just a hot day, hot November day. They were standing under an umbrella, just listening to the speech as well. And I was there just observing them, like, you know, and I could see they were getting emotional. Like, because it wasn't just from a cricketing sense. Like I said, it almost felt like, so what now? Like, you know, there is no Tendulkar in our lives in terms of, you know, when you watched Indian cricket, you watched Tendulkar. It just, like, you know, and he started in the 1980s, like I said, in 89. By the time he finished in 2013, India didn't look the same. I mean, India looked like a different country altogether. Like, you know, so much had changed in India, and a lot of that had to do with Sachin Tendulkar. I mean, I don't think there's anything more I can say about his cricket. Like, you know, one of the greatest batsmen the world has ever seen. In some people's books, the greatest batsman ever. There was nothing imperfect about him. He had his own ways of playing cricket, but, you know, there are so many innings that have inspired the future stars. Like Virat Kohli will talk about his great innings in the UAE in 98 against Australia. You know, there are just so many moments to... So to just sum up what Sachin Tendulkar is, he's Hulk Hogan. And the fact that, like I said, he defined that era, which is a 24-year-long era. He was Hulk Hogan, The Rock, John Cena, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Undertaker, Goldberg, all of them put together, and multiply that by 5. That's how big a name Sachin Tendulkar was and always will be, you know, for not just cricket, but for India as a whole. Like I said, he really, India was already on the map, but he kind of just like, you know, surrounded India's position in the map with all these bright lights. He made India matter.
Do you think there will ever be a cricketer as loved as Sachin Tendulkar was?
I don't think so, because I think the era, the world has also changed. I think what also worked back then was because there was no social media. Like when he wasn't playing cricket, you know, there are so many stories. He's never lived a normal life from the time he was 16, right? There are so many stories about even back in the 90s when he had to go watch a movie, had to wear a cap or fake beard. They had to lock the whole theater out. So he would watch movies in empty movie theaters just so that he can lead a semblance of a normal life. And like, you know, it also happened when there was no social media. You weren't so exposed. These guys, these days, you look at Virat Kohli or the stars of today, not just in cricket, anywhere, in wrestling as well. Like, you know, there's that, they don't have that enigma, that aura of like, you know, is he even real or is she even real anymore? Because they become very real. They become normalized because of social media. You see them do normal things. Back then, like, you know, you didn't know what Sachin Tendulkar was up to when he was not, even though I grew up in the same city. I played cricket growing up in this for the same club that he had played at for at one point. Where else would you go and play cricket, right? You had to go to the Kamath Memorial Cricket Club and start cricket with the hope that you would also have a career like him. Well, clearly I didn't. But anyway, but you know, so he, but there was that aura about them. I think it's gone. I'm sure there'll be. And so now you get to see different sides of a cricketer as well. So you can choose. And we're also living in an era where some people just out there look, they're always finding something or want to find something that they can criticize. So I think the world has changed. It'll never happen. That level of love or that level of, you know, nobody, there'll be no other god in Indian cricket ever. Nobody will be referred to as a god. I remember when he became the first Indian to make a double or first cricketer to make a double hundred in one day cricket and 50 over cricket. The our Indian Express, the newspaper, like a very liberal newspaper, very like a newspaper which never got carried away. One of the main reasons I existed there. They had a headline. It was a picture of Tendulkar with his arms aloft, like, you know, looking up into the sky. The headline just said God. You know, that, like, you know, I was shocked when I saw it, but that's how much he meant to India. And he always will mean to India.
Well, thank you for sharing all that, brother. That was a time in cricket that I missed that I wish I could find a time machine and go back, even if it's just for one match, and see the greatness of Tendulkar in person. And thank you all so much for tuning in to Chop On. We really appreciate the love and support we've been receiving. Bharat, do you have any last words for our listeners before we head out of here this week?
Well, all I have to say is, like, look, I mean, look at the names that Raju mentioned at the start. John Cena, Conrad Thompson, Jeff Jarrett. Just a matter of time before The Rock and Hogan and all of them are going to follow Rajiv. So as much as I want you guys to jump on board, chop on and, like, you know, shower us with your love, don't forget to do the same with Talking Dreams, because, you know, it's got the rocket ship attached to its posterior. It's going places. So is my good friend, my brother, my co-host Rajiv. So give him a follow as well. He's the expert on all things in the world.
Thank you for that, brother. That really means a lot. And all of you, don't forget how amazing of a writer Bharat Sundaresan is. His book, Believe, My Life in Cricket. What Life in Cricket Taught Me is out now. I'm sorry, but it made a face and that threw me off. It's Believe, What Life in Cricket Taught Me by Suresh Raina and Bharat Sundaresan, and it's available on Amazon, so go check that out. And don't forget to also grab the Dhoni Touch while you're there. That is another amazing book by Bharat Sundaresan. And you can find our show here, Chop on Twitter and Instagram at Chop On Pod. On Twitter, he is at BeastieBoy07. I am at TheRajiv8. Keep chopping on, people.